2 weeks ago, we left off with Revelation 12. There is a lot here, and it may be good to go back and review some of the things that we talked about, at least to kind of recap. We have finished up pretty much with the first 6 verses and even said a little bit about verse 7. Let's go back and read chapter 12, verses 1 through 5. We'll make a few remarks, and then we'll pick up with verses 6 and 7 and hopefully kind of refresh ourselves. John said, Revelation 12, 1, and a great sign was seen in heaven, a woman arrayed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was with child, and she crieth out, travailing in birth, and in pain to be delivered. And there was seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his head 7 diadems, or 7 crowns. And his tail draweth the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon standeth before the woman that is about to be delivered, that when she is delivered, he may devour her child. And she was delivered of a son, a man-child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and his throne. We said, beginning in Revelation 12, 1, we have a sign. And not only did John say there was a sign, he says there was a great sign. So very, very important. We also talked about the word light in Revelation 12, verse 1. We said light, when we think about it, it can, a person says, well, now the light came on. The light bulb went off. Light, even in the secular realm, is often used to describe information. And in this particular case, we said that the light here seems to describe information, about God and spiritual things. Then we said that we have this woman. John uses this imagery at various times throughout this chapter. We also said that this symbol seems to have a twofold meaning. In the beginning part, it seems to describe religion that's authorized by God. And then, prior, of course, to the New Testament era, there was light, there was religion that had been authorized by God. And you've got much of that religion pointing forward to the time when Jesus was going to come into the world. So it's like this woman pictures Moses' law, everything that led up to Jesus coming, and then finally the time comes where this woman, all the things that God had used to prepare to bring Jesus into the world, she gives birth. And then that, of course, led to Jesus, Christianity, the establishment of the church, and all of those kinds of things. And then in verse 2, you have some information about this woman. Just as in the secular realm, a woman's pregnancy involves a lot of things, some of which are not all that pleasant. When you look at God's getting Jesus into the world, were there some complications? Yeah, you go back and you start looking at the Old Testament, and there were a lot of twists and turns, and a lot of very, at least from our perspective, difficulties for God's plan to redeem man to come into effect. So from Genesis all the way up to the book of Matthew, we see all kinds of opposition from the devil and sometimes even from people. Then in verse 3, John introduces us to what kind of dragon? He's the great red dragon. A literal dragon? No, it's a reference. Verse 9 tells us a little later who's the great dragon. Satan is. And John describes this dragon as having how many heads? 7. And we said before, 7, a number that's often used to describe completeness, fullness, perfection. 7 heads, and then he also has what else? 10 horns. Now, that could be literal, but I think, as we suggested 2 weeks ago, it's probably a figurative statement. The 7 heads, when you think about the head, what comes to mind? The head of state, we sometimes refer to. So here, the 7 heads would refer to 7, we said, world powers, big empires. And maybe not 7 literal ones, but when you think about the devil, if he can get civil authority on his side, is that going to help him? Sure. So when you think about governments, empires like Rome and Egypt, various world powers, when the devil was able to get them on his side, and he's still working in that same area today, very, very helpful to his cause. And then we have, in addition to the heads, we've got the horns. Which would be the more powerful image, the head or the horn? The head is. All right, so if those heads describes, world powers, then the horns, the lesser of the images, would suggest what? Lesser power. So it could be an individual nation at that point, or a kingdom and so forth. And next week we'll probably get into, or maybe 2 weeks from today, Revelation 13, and go back and explore this imagery a little more fully, because it's information that's pulled from the book of Daniel. But basically John is saying that the devil has, at times, civil authority on his side, civil power to go ahead and do some damage, inflict some punishment or persecution on God's people. One of the things I think that's interesting about this is that did John write this book before or after Jesus' ascension? After. So the Lord's back in heaven, and when we talk about the devil, we say that his power has been severely hindered. And yet, even though that's true, when you go back and you look at what John says, verse 3, and there was seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great. So when John thinks about the devil, even though this is after the time of Christ, does he still picture the devil as a powerful force? Yeah. So he's a creature that we really do not want to mess with. Then you have in verse 4, John talks about still Satan, this great red dragon, and he says that we've got the devil's tail. Well, probably not literally, but the devil has used his tail to reach up and take what part? Third part. Now, if you remember what we've said, we've got information in the book of Revelation about the third part and the fourth part. Anybody remember what we said about the fourth part of man? It describes the physical part. The third part describes the spiritual part. So when it says the devil, talking about this pregnant woman, all the things that led up to Christ in the New Testament era, he tries to bring down the third part of heaven. The people back there in the Old Testament, Job, Abraham, Moses, you think he was interested in their spiritual part to destroy it? He was. So even prior to the time of Jesus, the devil was trying to have a negative impact on the spiritual part of mankind. So rather than talk about literal stars, John's talking about people under the Old Testament era who suffered attacks on their faith by Satan. And then in verse 5, we said this single verse sums up really the entire life of Christ. And she was delivered of a son. The time came where all those Old Testament plans for Jesus and Christianity were fulfilled. Jesus comes into the world. He's that man-child. He gets to the point where he's able to rule all the nations with the rod of iron. And then at the end of verse 5, what's said? He was caught up. What's that tell us about the Lord? All right, he ascended into heaven. So everything that led up to Jesus, he did what was necessary to rule, and now he's in heaven ruling. So Revelation 12:5 is, like I say, it sums up just a terrific amount of time and many, many different events. Okay, let's then pick up with 6 and 7 to get us really where we need to be today. And the woman. Now remember what's happened with this pregnant woman. She's still pregnant or not? She's given birth. So the Messiah has now come into the world. So John is now using this word woman in a different way, still using it to talk about religious things, spiritual things, but now this woman takes on the sense of the New Testament church. This woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, and there they may nourish her 1,260 days. And then in verse 7, where we stopped 2 weeks ago, and there was a war in heaven, Michael and his angels going forth to war with the dragon, and the dragon warred with his angels. At this point, Christianity has been established, and John could have continued to talk about some things, but he switches gears a bit, and he's staying focused on the woman, but as I said, now he assigns a new image to it. You have here reference to the church, and Satan wasn't able to stop Christ from coming into the world. He was there. He wanted to devour the child, as we read about, to destroy Jesus. That didn't work. So you've got the Lord out there in the wilderness. Satan's tempting him. That doesn't work. And various things. Finally, Jesus is killed. You remember that about the time for the Lord's Supper, Satan entered into Judas. That didn't work. Everything failed. So now, since Satan wasn't able to destroy Christ, the church came into existence. What's the devil want to do? Got to go after the church. So John pictures God's people as going into the wilderness. Now we said last week, when you begin to look at that word flee, even the nation of Israel, the nation of Israel, and I gave out a chart 2 weeks ago, the nation of Israel was out there in the Old Testament. What did it need as it was in the wilderness? You're going to go out camping. What do you need? You need food. Didn't God's people need that? All right, so God provided the manna, the quail, and so forth. They need water? Sure. Well, all of those things were great, but ultimately, that water in the wilderness pointed forward to what? Jesus, John 4, the woman at Samaria, I'm going to give you living water. So the people in the Old Testament had water, physical water, but that pointed forward to the spiritual water that was going to provide. Old Testament Israel received that physical manna, but that pointed forward to what? The bread of life, John 6, which comes through Christ. And then you have some people that fled as well. Moses, didn't he have to flee? Killed the guy in Egypt. Where does he run to? He flees over to the land of Midian. Book of Exodus tells us about that. You've got Israel, they're fleeing from Egypt and so forth. So all that Old Testament stuff pointed forward to the New Testament era. All right, now you have in verse 7. There's this war in heaven. Michael, his angels are going forth to war with the dragon. The devil, he engages in a war with his angels. Now some people think that this refers to Satan's fall. I don't think so, because of the preceding information. We're not somehow just kind of jumping ship. But John has logically been talking about all the things that led up to Jesus coming. He's paid the price for sin. And then now he talks about this war in heaven. Well, if you look at the context, that war would not be Satan's fall way back when, but it is Satan's downfall because of what? What happened? All right. Christ has come. He's died for sin. He's established the church. And what's that done to Satan and his forces? Sucked a lot of the wind out of the power that he had. So when we look at Satan, and we'll do a little of this in today's class, when we look at Satan prior to the sacrifice of Jesus, it looks like he had a great amount of power, many, many privileges, if you will, when it came to going to God and making accusations against God's people. Remember how the book of Job opens? Satan, it looks like he's got pretty much free access to God's throne. And God asks the question, have you considered my servant Job? And what does the devil say about Job? Oh yeah, he's a good guy, but what? You've got this hedge around him. And if you took all that stuff away, what kind of guy would he be? Yeah, he's going to turn from you. He's not going to be a good guy. Well, that's a pretty serious allegation. But it seems like the devil was pretty free and had a lot of authority in that kind of area. And then too, you have the other thing. Somebody says, well, I'm going to pay the bill. If you're the fellow that is owed the money, you might say what? You've made the promise, but where's the money? You've not paid it. You think the devil could have done that as well? Here's a person, God says, I'm going to, you know, he's one of my people. And the devil says, he's not perfect. God says, well, payment is on the way. Christ is going to die for sin. If Satan wanted to play hardball, what was he able to say? He hasn't paid yet. And until that bill's paid, it's just a promise. How do I know that that promise is going to be good? So he had, as we look at things, not good, but he had several things that he could have used to try to launch as an accusation. Let's see where I want to... And that goes back to attacking the third part of man that we saw earlier from Revelation chapter 12. Now, as this battle wage prior to the cross. I think you have a hint of some of the things that were going on. Let's have somebody head back to the book of Genesis for a second. Genesis 28, verse 12. And let's head another person back. You'll have a few minutes to get here. Let's go back to the book of Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 3. Who wants to be our Zechariah reader? You'll have time to find it. Bonnie, and then Jeff, if you'll go back to the book of Genesis, and we'll look at the, as I said, the 28th chapter, verse 12. Zechariah 3, Bonnie, is where you want to find. Okay, if you're ready, Genesis 28, verse 12.
And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angel of God were ascending and descending on it.
Okay, now this is interesting. We've got this Jacob's ladder, as we sometimes hear it described. And who or what's going up and down the ladder? Angels. Why do you think they're going up? Well, let me back up and preface that question with this one. The ladder reaches where? Between heaven and earth. All right, so there's something going on with these angels. There's activity there. But it sounds a little bit like Hebrews 1, verse 14. The Hebrew writer says, are they not, speaking of angels, all what kind of spirits? Ministering spirits sent forth to do what? For the sake of them that shall inherit salvation. So New Testament passage says angels are used to help God's people. Well, is that just a New Testament promise, or was there something to that under the Old Testament era as well? Well, Genesis 28, verse 12 would suggest that, good angels were also involved in helping people somehow. Now, exactly what they did, we don't have a lot of information about that. Angels were also involved in giving the law, Galatians 3, verse 19. And maybe with that reference in Genesis 28, 12, Hebrews 1, 14, maybe there's also the hint that angels were at least interested in and maybe somehow trying to help some of the folks, as Satan was accusing them. Let's take a look, Bonnie, if you will, Zechariah 3, verse 1.
And
Zechariah 3, verse 1, that first verse.
And he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him.
Okay, so you've got here a heavenly scene. You've got the devil there. And it seems like you've got some angels as well. Let's pick up also verse 4.
And he answered and spake unto those that stood before him, saying, take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with change of raiment.
Okay, now let's think about this. We've got the devil in what seems to be a heavenly setting. And read again the first part of that verse, Bonnie, and I'm going to stop you. All right, now there it is. He spoke to those before him and then said, you know, take off the clothes. Who do you think the servants were, those before him, that are pictured as taking off the unrighteous garments? Might they have been angels?
Angels.
I think that makes sense to me. So here you have, in the presence of the devil, the high priest. Satan is making accusations against him. Now think about the significance of that. If you can taint or successfully charge the high priest under the Old Testament with sin, what's that do to the rest of the priesthood? You know, it's like going to the water supply. If you can taint the main source of the water, then as that filters out to various places, you've got them all. So the devil surely is interested with the lower level folks, but if you can start at the hot top and go ahead and get them all. So one good picture of what the devil was doing as far as an accuser, and John in Revelation 12 specifically says, the devil has been an accuser. This is, as I said, an Old Testament reference, and yet God comes along and says, take the filthy garments off of him, in reference to sin. You can go ahead and cleanse him. He can be counted as righteous, as justified. Now, when we begin to think about this Old Testament war, there's another passage, and I'm going to read this one for you. It's in the book of Daniel. It's Daniel chapter 10, verse 13. This is interesting for a couple of reasons. We have a name that's given here, and you also have a reference to the prince of the kingdom of Persia. And this seems to be some kind of demonic spirit, demonic force. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 1 20 days, but lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, that seems to be the same Michael that's described in Jude 9 as the archangel. But Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. So once again, some small amount of spiritual insight as far as this spiritual battle that's going on between the angelic forces of good, the angelic forces of evil, and you just find quick snapshots of that. And this, of course, as I said, Michael, he's also mentioned in Revelation chapter 12, verse 7, there is and has been this ongoing battle. Well, Jesus' death on the cross radically changed some things. He makes statements to this effect throughout his life. One of them, I'm going to pick this one up as well, comes from the book of John, chapter 12, verse 31. It's a fairly well-known verse. Jesus said, now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of this world be cast out. The devil is going to have to surrender some of his power because of what Jesus did on the cross. We think about, for example, Matthew 28, verses 18 through 20. Jesus said, how much power has been given unto me? All power. All right, well, if I'm the one now who's been made in control, what's going to have to happen to the devil? He's going to have to give some things up. He's going to have to surrender some things. And then think about this passage that we have heard and we probably know so well. Romans chapter 8, verse 1. It should take on some new meaning when we think about what we're seeing in Revelation chapter 12. There is therefore how much condemnation? No condemnation to those who are in Christ. Now, prior to Christ, that state didn't exist. So, because it didn't exist, the devil had great power to accuse. Oh, that payment hasn't been made. This guy is guilty of sin. He's only being righteous because of your hedge. And now Paul comes along, knowing what John knows in Revelation chapter 12, and says, "There is, if you are in Christ, there is absolutely no condemnation for you because the blood of Christ is going to benefit you." And then we've not gotten here quite yet, but let's look ahead just a little bit. Revelation chapter 12, verses 8 and 9. And they prevailed not, that would be Satan and his helpers, neither was there any place found anymore for them in heaven. And the great dragon was what? he's cast down. His assault, his spiritual assault on mankind, that has been overcome. Jesus also talked about this. Remember in Matthew 12, verses 28 through 30, he said there's the strong man, and then there's a stronger guy that shows up, and what's he do to the strong man's goods? He binds him and takes what he has. And that is a figurative description for what Jesus did to the devil on the cross. There's still that spiritual warfare that we read about in Ephesians 6, verse 11. So Paul says you have to wear the Christian armor. He's still a great spiritual force that can do a lot of damage. But and we'll mention, I think, these verses again, but they tie in so well. The book of Revelation was written by who?
John.
What other books were written by the same author?
John.
All right, got the book of John, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, that John, and then we've got 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. Remember, as this writer writes 1st John, 1st John 1, verse 7, if we walk in the light, as he's in the light, what's the blood of Christ do?
Cleanses
us. It frees us from all unrighteousness. That's exactly the message of Revelation chapter 12. And it ties in with this war in heaven. You know, it's like saying, you know, if you're going to go out and fight some people, you know, with our modern warfare, you know, we've got tanks and we've got guided missiles and everything else. And you've got the Egyptians back there, you know, with bow and arrows and spears and chariots. Who's going to win? We just stay in the tank. Mow them down, right? I mean, there's no comparison. So when you think about the spiritual, you know, you've got this ongoing battle, you know, Daniel 10 and Zechariah chapter 3. You've got this spiritual battle going on in the past, and I don't want to say that both sides were equal, but let's say for the sake of illustration that the side of good was not able to fully use the sacrifice by Christ because it hadn't taken place yet. When the sacrifice of Christ was made, you think that changed the battle? Absolutely. I mean, then you have the situation like modern warfare being put in the context of going back and fighting the Egyptians. And I mean, Michael and his angels were just able to blast Satan and his devil, Satan and his forces. So you begin to see this a little later, Revelation chapter 20, verse 2. John says, Satan has been bound. Why? Because of the cross. So when we think about the cross, it opens up all kinds of interesting thoughts and avenues for us. Why have the Lord's Supper every Sunday? I think he can make an argument for that here. Because of the power, because of what it does concerning sin. Absolutely mind-boggling to me that if people had an understanding of this, they would say, well, let's have the Lord's Supper once a year or twice a year or once a quarter. Every single week because of what it does, what it's freed us from, and the changes that it's brought about.
You said they were more equal, but yet they weren't really equal because if they had help from the angels and from God, Satan was defeated.
I would agree, and that's why I said you kind of have to couch that in terminology where you don't go too far with that. But the sacrifice had not been made as far as a time event. So, but now it has been. So now there's no basis for an accusation whatsoever. Yeah, so. All right, Steve?
So this wouldn't refer back to Matthew 4, then, when Jesus is tempted by the devil?
As far as Satan's downfall? I think the primary meaning for the war here would be that Jesus' sacrifice on the cross has stripped Satan from much of his power. And as we're going to see, let's maybe hold on to your question a bit for verses 8 through 10. And a lot of that power would have been tied in with his interest and zeal in accusing people for sin. But let's just hold on to that for just a second. Okay, let's then pick up with verses 8 through 10, and there may be something else that from the additional discussion you want to add or ask. And they, that would be Satan and his forces, prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he that is called the devil, and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him. And I heard a great voice in heaven saying, now, notice how that's associated with this war, now is come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, who accuseth them before our God day and night. And they overcome him, how? because or by the blood of the Lamb, and because of the word of the testimony, and they love not their life even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe for the earth and for the sea, because the devil is gone down unto you, having great wrath, knowing that he hath but a short time. Verse 8 reinforces the observations that we made about verse 7. Jesus, the price that he paid on the cross, the sacrifice that he gave, that caused the devil and his helpers to be put into a position where they can no longer prevail. Success has been taken from the devil. And that prevail, as I understand it, means that he can no longer accuse God's people of sin. That ability has been taken away from him. Going back to what we find once again in 1 John 1, verse 7. The blood of Christ, remember the tense there? How often does it cleanse us from sin? It's continuous action. So sin comes up. Here's a person who's trying to walk in the way of Christ. And what happens to the sin? Comes up. It's gone. And it's gone so quickly, what's it do when it comes to the devil and making an accusation? There's no time. There's no opportunity. It's been ripped from his ability, which is a great, great blessing. So when we talk about 1 John 1, verse 7, it's a great passage by itself. But when we look at how this same writer describes the same thing, we find some added meaning when we look at Revelation chapter 1, verse Revelation 12 and 1 John 1, 7. And then when you look at 1 John 1, verse 9, Christ, his blood, frees us from how much unrighteousness? All. So once again, what does that do when it comes to the devil being able to accuse God's people of sin? He doesn't have any standing. There's no basis. It would be like a prosecutor going into a court and saying, well, we want to charge you with something. What are you going to charge him with? There's nothing here. We don't have any basis. And the judge says, well, what are you doing in my courtroom? So since Satan has lost much of his power, there's little for him to say or little for him to do in heaven when it comes to God's people. We might say, and one commentator described it this way, which I think is pretty good. He said the complaint department, the accusation department against God's people has been closed. Now the one thing that comes to my mind that would be an exception to that would be like the situation in Luke 16 or Luke 15. You have the fella, the father who has two sons, and the younger son goes where? Into that far country. You think at that point the devil has the ability to launch a complaint against him? Well, he's left the fold, hasn't he? He's gone out into the world. He's no longer walking in the light. So if we decide that we do not want to continue in the will of God, then Satan certainly has some options, some power, if you will, there, because the person has decided to go back into the world. But when we decide to stay in Christ, we're trying to do what's right, we've got the promises, Revelation 12 and 1 John chapter 1. Having said that, let's ask this. Does Satan still have the ability to tempt people? Oh yeah, he's still, like I say, many things have been limited as far as his ability to accuse us. But 1 Thessalonians 3, verse 5 specifically refers to the tempter or Satan. And this passage, of course, was written well after Jesus' resurrection. So Satan now must be content with serving, as Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4, 4, as the god of this world until time ends. Anything that you want to add or ask before we say a few more things? We have a lot of descriptions for Satan in the Bible. Verse 9 gives us a few. We have the great dragon, the old serpent, the devil, Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. And then in verse 10, we have additional confirmation, if you will, of what we said thus far. Satan has lost significant power through Christ's resurrection as well as his death. He hears this great voice. This is an important thing. Now is come the salvation. Well, what's salvation based on? Well, Christ, the sacrifice, and our acceptance of him. So that's exactly right. So by giving us this word, John tells us exactly what he is talking about. Then, of course, he continues to say that Satan has some high goals. He wants to do what with people? He wants to... All right, he wants to accuse. Anything else there? Do we have the word deceive or deceiver? Okay, we have that in verse 9, don't we? The devil and Satan, he's the deceiver. That is a present tense participle. So when we think about Satan, he's not interested in deceiving people, just once a century or, once every 10 years, once a decade or just from time to time. But the devil is a deceiver, present tense, ongoing action. And even for God's people, if he can deceive them in various ways, he's certainly interested and willing to do that. But he wants to deceive how many people?
The whole world.
You think that statement Could be understood literally?
I think it's literal.
I would be inclined to think that that's very literal. Now, can you imagine the aspirations of doing anything on a worldwide scale? That's pretty big. And I mean, it would be one thing to say, well, let's have a Walmart in every country, when you've got various governments that are opposed to some of the ideas that we have as far as the way that we see economics. That's probably a challenge. But when he says here the whole world, he's not just thinking in terms of, well, you know, every country, but he's thinking of the whole world in the sense of every person. So when we think about Satan and his mission, he's a mission-minded creature. And he's got a great, great goal. Not a good goal, but it is certainly a very significant goal. But he's got to contend with the fact that a perfect sacrifice has been made for sin, and that people, if they're now in God's kingdom, are going to be free from his accusations. You also see, I think, some of Satan's passion and zeal expressed by another point here in what we read. When John describes the accusations from the devil, what's he say about them? He was involved in accusing them before God how often? The end of verse 10.
Day and night.
Day and night. Well, I don't know that that's literally true in the sense, you know, we think of day and night. But it's probably an expression to describe what?
Continuous
action. I mean, I don't think heaven's got day and night. But it's a way of saying that the devil never quits. When he sees an opportunity to accuse someone, and he's lost that ability, as we said, for Christians right now, 1 John 1, verses 7 and 9. But when he sees an opportunity to accuse people, if he's able to take advantage of that, he is going to do that. So, yeah. Yeah, it is. And when you look, when you think about the devil, there are some things about him, at least to my mind, that seem odd. Why fight a battle if you know that you're going to lose? I mean, if you are absolutely guaranteed a loss, you know, why? You know, it's like these people that run from the cops. I had a police officer tell me about 25 years ago. He said, "I don't care if they outrun me. I've got a radio. You know, let him get 5 or 10 miles ahead. You know, we'll call out a helicopter." And with technology now, it's the same kind of deal. You know, you have to, in some circumstances, say it just doesn't make sense to do that because the end has already been determined. So, yeah, why he would do that, one of the things that we're going to see here, I think we mentioned this, when you look at verse 12, he says, "Woe for the earth and for the sea, because the devil has gone unto you." He has what? He has great wrath. When you look at the devil, especially in the book of Revelation, Satan is pictured as a very angry creature. Now, think about a person, doesn't have to be you, but think about a person who's been really, really angry. What kind of decisions are made when people are really, really angry? Yeah, not all decisions are rational. Now, Satan is a spiritual creature. There are a lot of things that we do not know about the thinking. But if there is any parallel between anger in this world and the next, it would seem to me, and you know, Satan is a thoughtful, reflective creature as far as being able to tempt people. But I'm inclined to think, and this is a personal opinion, but maybe that rage, Bonnie, in some respects, blinds him to the outcome. He is just so angry that he does some things that ultimately do not make sense. We had two or three hands flash. We'll start with here.
The LA police officer that adopted the bandit.
Sure.
That's a good example.
It's a perfect example, because here you have a fella who is obviously angry, but at the same time, there's enough rational thought there.
And he's going off the wall.
Right. He's not doing things that will immediately expose him and cause people to get him. So, I mean, there is a plan there that seems to be, in some respects, well thought out. So I think that's a great parallel. Very good. Scott, and then Larry will take your thought.
Could it be that you know the philosophy that says the path to heaven is a narrow path?
Mm-hmm.
Most of us choose the wide path, which is the easy path. I mean, if you just want to take as many of God's people as he can, even though he knows his father's lost, he's going to take as many as he can before he goes.
And, you know, that may be tied in with what Harvey was saying as far as the fella out there, the rogue policeman. He may realize that at some point he's probably going to get caught. But still, before I get caught, before that point comes, I'm going to take down as many people, family members, as I can. So there is sometimes that kind of thinking, and once again, that may have some parallels in the spiritual realm.
Yeah, that's my thought. It's not the war, it's the battle. You know that they don't lose the war.
Yeah.
But how many battles can you win?
Right. I'm going to inflict as much damage as I can on the other side before things conclude. So, and when you have somebody like that, you're dealing with somebody who's very, very dangerous. When you have somebody who has that kind of power and that kind of commitment day and night, I mean, it's, you know, you just want to stay away. So that's why the Bible encourages us to stay in Christ, to be there with the shepherd, and not stray.
And then the verse 12 says, but because he knows he has but a short time.
Yeah. So, once again, it's, you know, the fate seal. He doesn't have any hope of winning. He knows that. But, like I say, I think the L.A. situation, or the California situation, is a good parallel to that. But yeah, he does have that knowledge, and he's not crazy in the sense that he's unable to think, but absolutely driven by a lot of rage. Okay, a couple of the quick things I think that I want to point out to you. We don't talk about it too often, but when you think about the word accuse, what comes to mind? He's accusing someone. How could we relate that to another sin in the New Testament that would be at least somewhat parallel? Accusing someone. Sound a little bit like gossip? All right. When you think about Satan making statements about people that are not favorable, not kind, accusations, allegations about folks, when folks do that today, if folks do that today, that would really put him in the league with the devil. So it's really an activity that we would want to avoid. Okay, Satan's fall is, of course, very good news for us, man's spiritual blessings, the redemption that we have in Christ. The news is so good that John says a great voice was used to announce it. And then he uses other words, power, salvation. Salvation, of course, would tell us that everything that needs to be done for our redemption has been accomplished. Everything that we need to be redeemed from sin has been done by God. Power tells us that Satan, in his war against God, cannot win the fight. His fate, as Betty mentioned, is going to be sealed. It's through the blood of the Lamb. John mentions that we can be in the kingdom. And this kingdom, of course, is something that the Bible talks about in several places. Jesus began to talk about it. John the Baptist talked about it. The apostles talked about it as well. And in many places in the Bible, here would be one of those places, it's a way of describing Christ's church. We've accessed the blood of the Lamb, verse 11, if we're a Christian, and thus have all spiritual blessings. Now, a couple of the quick points I think that we can make as far as points of accusation. You think the devil today would like Christians to feel like, you know, they're unworthy, that they're deserving of accusation? Oh, well, I saw Glenda first, and then we'll take the thoughts over to the left. Say that part again.
If Satan doesn't accuse us to God when one of us say I were to die.
Okay.
And, you know, Satan wants my soul, and heaven knows I'm not perfect, and you think that Satan partners with God or has a count over each member of the church, because there's not many of us, so there's time. I mean, just the way out there for thought.
Well, the closest that I could give you to that, I guess, would be two things. Back there in Jude 9, but Michael the archangel, when contending with the devil, he disputed, it's not the soul, but or the spirit, but he contended about the body of Moses. So here's a situation where Moses has died, and at some point the devil is interested in Moses' body. Now, I find that to be interesting, and once again, we're going off the reservation a little bit, but if the devil was interested in the body, and for Moses, that could have been, you know, maybe set it up as a shrine, something like that, to ensnare the people of Israel. But if he was interested in the body, logically, it would seem to me that he would also be interested in the spirit. Because the spirit has eternal value, the body does not. So I don't think that would be a far stretch at all, if there's some hope that he has there. But I would also bear in mind what we find in Luke 16, where when you have the rich man and Lazarus dying, there doesn't seem to be a great deal of time between the death and the soul being transported to the Hadean realm. So if there is, would Satan, if he's involved in that kind of thing, you know, be looking at a person's life and say, okay, it looks like this person is close to the end of life. When he or she goes, I want the eternal spirit of that person. I don't know, but to me that would be one of the interesting things. But if that's done, you can... Sure. You can tie in some other passages as well. Hebrews 7:25 says that Christ saves his people to the uttermost. Now that's an interesting statement. What does that mean exactly? Well, we would say, okay, forgiving sins. But does maybe that involve the idea that when a person dies, that Satan has some hope of trying to claim their soul and Christ saves us to the uttermost? That is, he sees us safely into the Hadean realm? It could be broad enough to mean that. You would also take maybe 1 Timothy 2:5, that Christ is our mediator. How far does that extend? Would he also, when it comes time for us to leave this life, also say, this is one of the righteous, and this needs to be the home? Whether or not those passages have any application, if Christ is our advocate, if he is the captain of our salvation, as the Hebrew writer talked about, then whatever is necessary to see us through the problem of sin in this life and deal with that problem, you know, after death and on the day of judgment, he's going to do that. But Satan will, like I say, do whatever he can. But John makes it clear here in Revelation chapter 12 that his ability to accuse the righteous, that privilege, that right has been stripped from him. Who was the other person that wanted to toss something out? Okay. Well, let's see. About 2 minutes left. Let's see what else I wanted to give you. Let's go back to the point that I was making just a minute ago. Today, you think people can feel like they're unworthy and they sort of accuse themselves at various times? I'm unrighteous, I'm unworthy, and they can just go down. Well, Revelation 12 is a chapter that we should be familiar with and come back and read. Because what's it say? We've been freed, we've been redeemed, we've been cleansed. If Satan has no basis to accuse us, if we're trying to walk in the light, and that doesn't mean that we're going to be perfect, then what should we do? We should say, those accusations against self, where are they coming from? The devil. And he doesn't have the right to do that to us before God. Well, if he doesn't have that right, then what right do we have to accuse ourselves? So, it goes back to what we said from 1 Thessalonians 3, verse 5. The devil is a tempter. Remember what we said, too, about the devil in Revelation chapter 12? He wants to deceive, doesn't he? How many people? The whole world. And you think some of that deception might be directed towards us? It can be when we think about some of these things that we just mentioned. Then we have this other quick thing describing Satan as a serpent may have been especially interesting and useful to these people because in the first century there were a lot of the pagan gods that used snakes in their religious rites. So to use this imagery, among others, for these folks, it would have made a lot of sense that Satan is a false god.